I just have to say for a minute who I am. My basic training is in mathematics, but for the last 3.5 years, I have assumed the position as the head of Mathematical Sciences Publishers in Berkeley, which is a joint publication endeavor between Berkeley and Warwick, whose objective is to really produce high quality journals at a rock down price in order to provide more access to mathematical literature as a whole. We started producing about 5 journals about 3.5 years ago. We are right now producing about 35 and increasing. Recently, one of our flagship journals, which is Geometry and Topology, which is about 10 years old right now, has hit number one on Science Citation Index in among specialty journals. We still have Annals of Mathematics and GEMS, the Journal of the MS, ahead of us, an overall index. This is a dramatic achievement, especially if you look at the Ulf Remen's list of journals prices. You can see that if you order that by price per page, we figure out pretty much down there at the bottom. This one here, I'm on free journals. There's only 3 people behind us. As the cheapest journal available in mathematics today. We publish at 8 cents a page compared to some other publishers like Elsevier, which run about $4 a page and $5 a page, two levels of magnitude higher. One of the things that most interested me there was to set up the infrastructure to be able to produce those on a mass scale and to be able to do that in an effective way so that we can propagate the system out to other people and be able to achieve the task of putting out the literature for a cheaper price. Tech has changed us into our own typist and allowed us to take care of our own publication needs, but the system to put out those publications out there didn't quite exist. And one of the things that MSP is addressing is the system to deliver those, including indexation and sometimes printing. Some of our customers need printing, so we do that from time to time. So one of the things that I wanted to show you is, for example, one of the journals that we produce, the Pacifica Journal, we just finished a project of restoring it back 10 years, so that there's a total of 10 years of it online, available strictly from sources. The journal is available back 55 years, but completely based on images and not on source. What you see in there is, you know, the magic of Eitan Gurari, pretty much working on top of our structured metadata that we work for all those files, which is one of the pinpoints of our preservation strategy. If you look at any of those files, for example, we came across this preservation strategy from the point of trying to increase the usability of the files. There was sort of among MSP a general idea that we would like to increase the usability of the PDF files from what we currently had, which was mostly an image file and nothing else. So I'm not so sure that I'll be able to show you that unless somebody can come over here with a machine that has Acrobat working, because my Acrobat works. Okay. So one of the things that we do in order to increase the usability of our files is The files are completely internal linked. I mean, this is a simple usage of an extension of HyperRef, and I hope to open the PDF file in here right now. Just one second. And if I can click here on this particular file. If Acrobat plays with me. So what you see there is an example of one of those files. So if we move over to the first page, you can see that there are some, if I can remove this black box from the bottom so I can click on it, you'll see that what we have there is the normal link that you may see on many other publishers. And one thing that we add to that is that if you move over to the citation area, if you move over to the bibliography area, each and every one of the bibliography entries which are available on the web is hyperlinked in there. So if you go into this particular link here, which is linked via the DOI, and if you clicked in there, if this machine would respond, you would be able to see immediately the particular source file for that particular entry. There are many other things we're doing. There's an internal linking of the paper itself. In mathematics, this helps quite a bit. We have started implementing a check on citations for forward citations on the paper where an author explains a particular lemma, number 3, with something which is proved only 5 pages down the line. And in fact, the Pacific Journal of Mathematics had about 3 papers being withdrawn over the last 2 years because of circle arguments on the citations alone. And we're trying to deliver those tools to the community so that, you know, the use can be extended and pushed further. For this restoration of the Pacifica Journal and all the other journals that we have there online, all those bibliography entries were moved from BBL files into BibTeX files. And I probably know every single bug that BibTeX has at this point by heart. And a lot of griefs and a lot of to discuss with Oren if he shows up here at this meeting. Oren. He'll be here all day tomorrow. I'll rent him out. and our servers literally, we have about 30,000 papers online at this point, and about 500,000 citations. And our servers are constantly 24 hours a day mining the CrossRef database, the MassSciNet database at AMS, the Zentralblatt database back in Germany, the NumuDem database, and individual publishers that post their stuff online but do not have a specific way to do it, but for which we have figured an algorithm to go there and fetch those articles. There's about 500 of those algorithms, and this database is being mined day in and day out. When a journal for, like, say, Journal of Trenchard Geometry decides to go online with its content, our stuff acquires about 100,000 links overnight. And the PDF files are regenerated all over again. And for a user that comes back the day after, he'll get a file which is much better linked and much better prepared than the way before. Now, how does that have to do with preservation? And that's the heart of the question, is this revisitation of the file that brought us to the point of a better preservation strategy. Is the necessity to go there every day and reprocess that file every day that brought up many, many issues with, you know, with packages which are changed, packages in LaTeX which are changed and are incompatible with the package that was there the day before, or which are compatible but metrically different in such a way that the PDF files that you produce are completely different from the PDF file that you would have produced the day before. So we had to build a strategy for that regeneration of the PDF files. And So let me go back to the presentation if I can. And so that shows the internal link, the external link, and then I would like to talk a little bit about the preservation strategy. You know, the magnitude of the problem is well known. Everybody knows that, you know, the Gutenberg's Bible was produced about 500 years ago. You have much better examples of that. Archimedes' Palimpsest was produced about 300 BC and is still available and still readable, thanks to the monks that tried to erase it and wrote, you know, books of praise on top of it and preserved it in the monastery in Turkey for so long. And to this point, you can literally go online and examine all those manuscripts one by one. The Palimpsest, you know, again, it's imaged. People have been able to trace the metal which Archimedes used to write the book, and the image files are available, and one can read, one can sort of skip the Book of Hymns on top of it, and read all the material which is available underneath. At the same time, while those two books are available, the Gutenberg Bible is available all over the place. The British Library has two volumes of it. Keio Library has one, Göttingen Library has another one, and bunches of private collectors have copies of the Gutenberg Library. So something produced in paper, first book ever printed, is widely available. But the census of 1960, most of the data that has been collected in the census of 1960 has been completely lost and unavailable at this time because it was the first census that was ever produced on a computer. I should make a remark in here. There's a lot that has been said about the census of 1960. In fact, not all data has been lost. The data has been collected and processed, and the data that has been processed and photographed on microfiche, that data is preserved, the processed data or the results or the averages and so forth. But the entire raw data of the census has been collected, and they have been taped on what I don't know if you remember that, but on tapes made out of paper, which UNIVAC introduced to replace the punch cards. Punch cards have been used to collect this data since 1920s, and most of those are still available and still functional and can be read to this date. But there was a transition in the technology at that point. They were replacing the cards with the tapes, which were supposed to be faster and accumulate more data in it. And these tapes do exist right now at the National Archives, and they're deteriorating to the point that they cannot even be opened anymore. IBM had promised the National Archives a couple of times to build a tape reader to read it. Promises have never materialized, and now that IBM is half owned by some other country, so that may not never materialize. So the problem is only getting bigger, and it's getting bigger because we are at the point where there's been another shift in the technology, which is we're changing from a model that we no longer printing some of the stuff, and that has given us the freedom to produce way more material. The amount of printed word in the world has always grown exponentially, and this is since the time of the scribes, because the process of one taking a copy and making two copies leads to exponential growth. The only thing that Gutenberg really did that was moving is that he increased the rate of the growth, the exponential growth. And this exponential growth has been slightly disturbed, slightly off during World War I, because Germany had a lot of the printing power under their control. And the exponential growth continues unabated even during World War II, because by that time United States was already producing a large amount of printed material, that the lack of production in Germany didn't affect the total production at all. And everybody thinks that the amount of printed material right now is increasing at a much faster pace because of production of paper is increasing very, very fast. But nonetheless, it is pretty hard to gauge and pretty hard to find out where we're going to be preserving all this material. So once we state the problem, you know, what's the solution? Mostly for the fact that, mostly for the material that that we have produced, which is not available in print, that can be preserved in the same way that Gutenberg's Bible has been preserved. So before I would not, I'd like to analyze some of the misguided efforts in that direction. And one of the big misguided efforts in preservation of online material, preservation of print material, is PDF-A, PDF archival. Because PDF archival does not allow the publisher to be creative, does not allow a publisher to insert new material or to insert new media inside. It's very restrictive. In fact, it demands that you include all the fonts in there. And if you already have 30,000 papers that you have to include the fonts for each one of them, you probably know that it won't fit on any hard disk that you can get a hold of at this point. And the fact that there is no external viewer, the fact that you can't add any of the new technologies that have been discussed in here, like animations and so forth, restricts the publisher so much that the publisher himself is not going to be willing to produce any material in PDF-A unless it's strictly for handing in the archival or following some contract that has been given for him to sign. Not only that, but it's very restrictive on many other areas. It does not even allow you to use transparency in PDF. So what I propose for solution is that the only solution is a text source content. And for text source content, I mean, it wasn't very clear to me that the only strategy for preservation, for long-time preservation, was based in TAC. Until about, I had a conversation about 3 years ago with a new publisher in San Francisco that was opening a very prolific publisher that has opened in San Francisco about 5 years ago, Public Library of Science, that was publishing a lot of journals in medicine, biology, and all of a sudden they opened a journal in computational biology. And as soon as they opened the first journal in computational biology, they got a submission in TAC. And they had no idea what to do with that, and they came over to Berkeley to ask what they could do with that. And at that point, we kind of talked on the table, and I said, well, what you can do is just process it, you know, process it with PDF LaTeX, and you get PDF out of it, and you're done. I says, well, no, we want to convert it to Word. And because that's, you know, what we have for our journal workflow. And I said, well, then you have a problem, you know, not a problem converting that to Word, because converting that to Word, you may pay somebody to typeset that in Word, and you have it. But the problem is that, you know, tools like Microsoft Word are based, their income stream are based on the fact that it is incompatible with the same source format some 4 years ago, or some five years ago, so that they can keep selling you a new version of Microsoft Word every 4 years or so. And then it was very hard to get that point across, and so I asked a very basic question, you know, suppose the day that the PDFs that you have in your hand are no good, what do you do? I said, well, PDFs are good forever. I said, whoa. I mean, this is a very big statement. You know, we took about a 15-minute detour, and I showed him plenty of PDF files that had been generated by Adobe themselves, circa 1992, 1993, that were not readable in Adobe Acrobat 7 at that time. And so pointing out very clear that PDF preservation is not a path at all. And well, I said, well, as soon as PDF 9 or PDF 11 comes about, we'll save that in a PDF file. And then the problem comes, you know, what if you have 50,000 papers at that time? And you can't really open 50,000 papers and save that in PDF. And his CTO at that time says, well, we'll just have something that will, you'll know, scripting interface. And indeed true, he come out with a solution that was able to open up a file in Word and say file open, blah, 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 and go through the process of saving PDF, which is some like 25 clicks. And the 25 clicks were automated, and the file could go one by one and open 50,000 files and save all of them in PDF. The only problem an easy computation would say that would take like about 2 months for it to open 50,000 files and save that back again. And the guarantee that you had something that looked like the one before was close to nothing. We never convinced him to move his journal to TechSourced. He continues to produce his journal as Microsoft Word based, but he frequently visits us in Berkeley to learn about preservation of his own archives, which I have very little to say about. the other crucial point. I should say that that when I say text source content, I meant well structured text source content, and that brings it to the next slide, which is structured content for this metadata. The metadata has got to be completely used as a one source and very well structured. As you probably seen. On the example I gave you from the Pacific Journal, this entire page is produced directly out of the text source, and because of the well-structured metadata that we have, including the abstract that you see in there, which is produced in MathML by Tangurari's Tech4HT. Now, writing something that tech can understand is very easily, but writing something that Perl can understand and that Python can understand and produce web pages and produce MathML is a little bit more difficult, and you have to write way more structured content. Fortunately enough, we have a front end right now, which takes care of our queue for journal management. And that entire queue, when a certain paper is accepted, to put that particular paper ready with the metadata ready. So that if a paper has author such and such and such with address and email or whatever, it goes down. Instead of the three lines, / author, / title, / date, we'll write something like 60 lines of metadata. But the complete metadata is in there, and we can easily tackle the paper down on the bottom and proceed down to the next step. The other one, which is really, really, really important, is the archival of every single package you use as a separate file. I learned that the very hard way. There are many, many, many packages in tech, many, many packages that tech authors have lots of worries about compatibility, about lots of other things. They have no worries about preservation and future of that particular package. And so it's absolutely necessary to take a snapshot of that particular package in that particular time, space and time, and archive it together with the paper if you want to be able to reproduce that paper with the same line breaks and the same page breaks that you had before. I should say that the suite of regeneration of each one of our files that go there and update the bibliographies as new links are acquired, we'll check the new file produced for the termination of every line in the PDF file, the termination for every page, to make sure that they agree with the previous file that have been there. But the only thing that you're adding to the file is a link and not new break or new pages or anything. So we go through that step as well in our runs of LaTeX, do archive, our final run of LaTeX on any file, do archive the entire set of files that have been used to produce that particular file. And the other one is to visit your file, and if possible, every day. Because otherwise, you have no guarantee of the integrity of the database. The need for that is now much bigger than it was before, because people are demanding to have files which are usable, which are, have that can be extended, and then files that can be added to it. We have several authors that have asked to add stuff to their existing file, and we're opening the possibility for them to be able to add an extra pages at the end of their file, and that they can make comments of their own mistakes or their own for their achievements on the paper and add them to the file. But not only that, there are new technologies coming down the corner. You may have to regenerate your file over again. One of those technologies that you may have heard is XPS. And XPS, I'm not a very fond of many products that Microsoft puts out, but this is a tremendously good one. and is a technology which is going to dispute space with PDF. The only difference is they have, you know, 15 years of what went wrong with PDF in hindsight, so that they can make things a lot better. And they have, in fact, done so. The format is completely XML-based to begin with, which is completely structured in that particular way. And it displays very nicely, you know, has rendering technologies which are very well done. It displays, for example, on 75% of the installed browsers in the world. It's only Internet Explorer, but nonetheless, it's there. And in fact, in order to put some of the discussion here yesterday into perspective, a lot that Adobe is doing with PDF right now have to do with XPS breathing down their neck. And the fact that Adobe has decided to move PDF into an ISO standard have a lot to do with that. Adobe have been trying for 13 years or more to get manufacturers of printers, for example, to manufacture PDF printers, and they have never been able to get one taker for that task. Mostly because of how much they charge for a PostScript printer, which is on the order of $92 for each printer that is sold that contains a PostScript technology. And printers, when they were doing this, which was at the beginning of Apple and Adobe, printers, laser printers used to cost $7,000. Printers are being given for free right now. No one can pay $100 of royalties to manufacture a printer. Just to give you an idea, Microsoft Windows charges about $3.50 for the operating system that runs the credit machines that you use to pay at pump stations. So the royalties are incredibly low numbers on the $3 and $4 and $5 range. So Adobe will never get a taker for a PDF printer. Well, has never got anybody willing to manufacture a PDF printer. And the XPS format has already a couple of takers. Both Ricoh and another Japanese manufacturer have already produced XPS printers. So there is a chance that XPS, which is now has a total path from Microsoft Windows all the way to the printer in native format, which is what PostScript used to do in the 80s, is going to do. And we may have a version of XPS LaTeX sometime down the line. For the ones that follow up the mailing list, there was an April Fool's joke this year. But I wish that particular April Fool's joke would materialize and would have an XPS LaTeX. And the ability and the necessity to produce and reprocess your LaTeX files is an absolute must. And the care that you need to exercise for that is, it's very high, but it will pay off at the end. Having image files for a journal which has been produced in the 80s, for me, is a pity. The Pacific Journal itself has been produced using LaTeX since 1985, but due to our bad habits, it's only 1995 and on that we're able to produce PDF files from source. And so the files from 85 to 95 are your standard fare image files that, you know, there are almost no use beyond the paper. I hope to have shown a little bit of the need for the text source per se. Without that, I don't think we can even think of producing a journal that will have a very well-defined future for a file that's with high usability. Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
How are you able to keep your costs so low, or how are the other publishers, why are they keeping their prices so high? I mean, do you see a time when there's going to be real competition?
Well, the question is why? How can we keep the cost so low? And what other publishers, you know, would other publishers follow suit to some extent? I don't think that the big publishers, the big publishing houses, will ever follow suit on anything. Elsevier and Springer and other publishers of the kind are sitting on tremendous amount of content, and in fact, Elsevier has already started making libraries pay all over again for content that they have already paid. If you go, for example, for lecture notes in mathematics, even though your library may have bought that from volume 1 to volume 2000, Electronic Access includes a new, totally different license, got nothing to do with the paper, and they got libraries paying for that all over again. So that is generating a huge stream of money for them, and I don't think they will abandon that. It's hard to lump everybody. You know, for example, one of the publishers represented here is the AMS, and the AMS does a lot of other things with the money that they collect on publications. You know, meetings, subsidized meetings, and subsidized lots of other activities. SIAM does the same thing, IEEE does the same thing. So they use publication money to subsidize other activities in the field. So I would assume that at those houses, even though they have the prices which are lower, also very, very low on the market, the AMS prices, SIAM prices, and IEEE prices are also very low, they will continue to stay at that level because they provide the income for the other activities. What we're trying to do is trying to say to a board of a journal, the editorial board of a journal, you don't have to stay with any publisher that you don't think is fulfilling the promise of give you access, generalized access to science. You can say no, you can quit and come over and we'll open up a new journal and start out from, you know, volume 1 if you don't have the rights to the name of your journal, but fill out the promise of access at a very, very low cost. Geometry and Topology is almost a given for free. Subscription is $140 a year for a journal that published more than 3,000 pages. Such a journal in the big houses has a subscription price which varies in between $4,000 and $5,000. No, I should say yes. we subsidized. We have a small room. We have a network for free, given by University of California and University of Warwick. We pay for our telephone. We pay for our costs. We pay for all the editorial work. We pay for everything else. We have room in that work for free.
So your subscription base is paid?
Yes, for everything else, everything else.
Are you archiving in tech? You see tech as your archive?
Yes.
Why not XML? Why not MathML? You can't really call tech an archive.
Because
you, if you want to reuse your content in future, you can't really guarantee. It is not structured.
Yes, that's
if
correct.
If you have a full structured ETD, then it's not really guaranteed.
I can fully agree with that. But we have, we have about 500 papers that come in the door every day, every month, and that needed to be processed and need to be put out. And I can have all those files structured. It will cost me a huge amount of money.
Wait a minute.
I don't think there's anybody using that amount of money to do that.
Not that amount of money.
Yeah.
You'd have to pay. I mean, if you had everything in XML and MathML, you couldn't charge $140.
That's correct. If we want to go to a higher level of integrity of your internal archive, we would have to spend more money.
But I agree that you will.
Yeah.
I disagree with that statement. I don't think that's clear at all.
That we would have to spend more money for that?
For example, if you collected the source from the authors,
uh-huh.
The way I think you should collect source from the authors, it'd be cheaper.
Well, but I don't think there's a lot here about, you know, humans, and I don't think you can get human beings to structure files in the way that I'd like to have them structured.
This community is the largest, maybe the only community, where you have large numbers of authors writing their own documents in markup.
Right.
And
thanks to Knuth.
The community needs to have his criterion met. The community only needs to slightly morph its habits. It does not need to change its habits in a big way.
We do try to get authors to do a lot for us, but what the problem is that you're not dealing with machines, you're dealing with human beings on the other side, and what you get back is non-uniform. Some authors do comply, some authors do give way more than what we need, and some authors, you squeeze them and there's nothing that you can get out of it. And so in order to obtain something which is uniform on our side, we will have to put a lot of work into it.
Freestanding validation, that's the point that he was making. You don't have freestanding validation.
That's true.
Source documents. And that imposes uniformity. And by the way, there's no style in that. The style is a wild card.
Right.
But the soundness of the document.
Okay.
The research I did last year showed conclusively there is no XML editor suitable for use by the average writer. Suitable for use by technical experts.
That's true.
People who know XML, but there is no XML editor suitable for use by the average author. It does not exist. Yet, some people are coming extremely close.
Hans? Yeah. I think the competition between XPS and PDF is very healthy, and lots of things are going to change in PDF because of XPS pushing them. But that is going to imply that every single publisher here will have to reprocess all those files back again. It's also good. You know, I have seen the display on Internet Explorer is great. You know, it needs no plugins like PDF does. It needs nothing. You know, it displays natively within the browser.
Is there an indication that Microsoft will provide keyword bound platforms?
Not so sure. Yes.
Do you reprocess the tech source that authors send you to make the journal
Oh, of course. I mean, we in fact provide lots of jobs for lots of people in third world countries, including Pakistan, India, and Afghanistan, Egypt, and so forth, and which do the processing of those files within the format. Lots of the metadata is already ready because that's a byproduct of the workflow tool that accepts the paper. But then the rest of the paper needs to be treated and needs to be brought in format and better for archival. We do that on a daily basis. Yeah.
What is the optimal format that you'd like to see? Can somebody just write a LaTeX article?
We do. Lots of people ask us for that, and they ask us for a style for the journal. We can't really send a style out for the journal because we use proprietary fonts in order to produce our papers. We put lots of weight on the Math Time font produced by produced by Spivak and distributed by PC Tech, and our journals are produced on those fonts. And we can't really ask anybody else to use those fonts and do line breaks and do page breaks based on that. So we let them do whatever they want, and we ask them to be plain, to use document class article,
right,
and send it over to us. The less you push them, the less errors you get back. All right, thank you.